You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simonow. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode as we try out brand new podcast software to see if it will make life better. Do we feel it will make life better? Fred just muted himself, so we'll see how that goes. Michael, do you think your life's going to be better?
It don't get no better than this, my friend.
It's going to take a lot more than podcast software to do that. All right.
There we go. See, right there, the good attitude. All right, let's start with something not going on in the world. Auto tariffs. From the Wall Street Journal, President Trump's auto tariffs won't just make buying a car more expensive. They would make simply owning a car more expensive, too. Levies on imported vehicles stand at 25%, and tariffs of the same size are planned for auto parts in early May. Now, we talked about that last week, I think, and Mike, we were talking about, like, yeah, if you need parts to repair your car, which is crazy. And they still haven't figured out what makes a car, and because there's nothing made purely in one country for like 40 years. And I think no one told the Donald this. So this is not going to be great for consumers, even for your insurance rates, apparently, because insurance companies like, it's going to cost us more, so it's going to cost you more.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot going on here and a lot of uncertainty, really, because it looks like the administration is doing, well, best we can tell, other than that it looks like, you know, a toddler's gotten hold of a tariff light switch and is flicking it on and off. We don't really know where the tariff situation stands because it looks like they're applying it to each manufacturer, right? We saw Hyundai kind of, you know, prostrate itself or throw itself at the mercy of the president and start promising to build factories in America, more factories, even though Hyundai and Kia, I believe, are both up in the list, pretty high in the amount of American-made vehicles that they produce. But there's kind of two parts to this, right? There's the tariff on new cars and the production of new cars and those parts that will be crossing borders in new cars. And that's the tariff that has supposedly coming into effect first, and then there's a separate tariff simply on parts that's going to come into effect, I believe, in May. And that's really where you're looking at driving up some costs for things like, you know, you get in a crash, your insurance company is ultimately going to be the one footing the bill for the tariffs. And we know that the insurance company is then going to raise insurance rates across the board to cover all those parts. I mean, the insurance companies are already stomaching some things that the auto industry has created, right? They're, when you get your windshield replaced now, for instance, no longer do they just have to replace your windshield, as Fred found out about after he the deer hit him. They have to go in and recalibrate and fix the ADAS systems, you know, anything from adaptive cruise control, blind spot monitoring, automatic emergency braking, anything that works with cameras or sensors that are embedded or work with the front windshield. Insurance companies are already kind of taking those costs on to make sure your car is recalibrated. I think like 90% of the recalibrations are covered by insurance. So that's ultimately raising rates already. But then beyond that, the crash parts that are going to be used to repair your vehicle after a crash are, you know, many of them come from overseas and many of them are going to jump in price. And that's, you know, this. I guess what I'm getting at is this isn't just about buying new cars. It's about, you know, the entire auto marketplace. I mean, you're going to see things affected like car seats. You're going to see, you know, all of the electronics that are going into our infrastructure and the safety infrastructure around us, all of the things that police and firefighters and EMS workers use in, you know, extracting crash victims and saving lives, all of these things are going to be going up in price. And so safety is getting a lot more expensive. And, it, you know, we're still trying to figure out who's in favor of this. The auto industry, I think, is kind of sitting on the fence saying, no, we don't really like these tariffs. But at the same time, they're trying to, you know, make friends and play nice with the administration that ultimately is clutching their pearls. So it's a crazy situation. It's just, you know, we know the auto industry hates uncertainty. And this is bound to create more of that, you know, with these policies. And not only that, it's this individual effort where certain companies seem or may be getting favorable treatment. You know, it's almost like the government is picking winners and losers, which makes me wonder if are we being led down a new path of socialism.
Oh, I like
it. Corporate
socialism.
Even worse, Michael, because you think of something like a catalytic converter, which is a very common crime, is to have your catalytic converter stolen off your vehicle in a parking lot. Those nominally cost over $1,000. So with the import duties, they're automatically going up to, what, $1,200, $1,300. But again, it gets even worse than that because they're filled with precious metals, most of which come from overseas. So the platinum and potentially iridium that's in them becomes yet more expensive. So you've got a 300%, or excuse me, 30%, 40%, 100% tariff on the precious metals that go into the catalytic converter, and then the processed catalytic converter itself comes to you. You know, all of a sudden you're up to $2,000, $3,000 for a part that some jackass stole and brought into a refinery. So, yeah, this is going down a road we really don't want to travel.
Right. Yeah, and yesterday China said that they were considering completely halting export of rare metals and minerals to the United States, which could be disastrous.
Well, yeah, because the samarium cobalt
for electric vehicles, I think.
Batteries go into all of these advanced electric motors. And samarium is a rare earth metal. Cobalt's generally produced from the Congo, I think, is where they find that. Maybe some of it up in Canada as well. So, right. Yeah, this is, I'm sure it makes sense to people way smarter than I am, but to me it sounds like just an ongoing disaster.
But I mean, supposedly the point of these tariffs is, if you follow the administration's line, is it's going to bring all of these jobs back to the United States. But there's some things that you just can't do that with, right? I mean, if we do have a large cobalt supply here, we certainly haven't found out how to access it. And doing that takes a lot of time. And, you know, it seems like the horizon for tariffs to actually accomplish bringing manufacturing back to the United States is a very long timeline. You have to prop up a lot of other industries that are going to, you know, mine this material and take the raw material and turn it into the other materials that are used to produce batteries and that type of thing. So it's not something that's going to happen.
You know, they could be just playing the long game because Elon Musk is one of the few people who's got billions of dollars in his pocket that would need to be raised by other companies who are trying to build the factories to respond to these ridiculous tariffs. So, this is going to go one of two ways. Either we'll have a war to resolve this, which is what happened with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, ultimately through the Depression into World War II, which eventually restored the economic balance in America, or you're just going to have to empty everybody's bank account to, you know, help somebody build a factory somewhere. I don't see much good coming from this.
Oh, man. I thought we'd have something to cheer for this week, and we just start off with this. Aw.
Well, I mean, it just doesn't seem like tariffs are going to have any positive safety impacts. I mean, and as far as consumer finance, I don't see a whole lot of you know, light on the horizon there. So yeah, bad news. Tariffs are bad news for auto consumers and possibly auto manufacturers. We're still trying to figure out who they're good news for.
Well, with that, I mean, maybe we just stop driving cars and move to mass transit. How do you think about that? Oh. That's right. Scientific American. According to the data, driving a car in the U.S. is far more dangerous than taking public transit in terms of crash risk and crime. That part surprised me. Still quoting from the article, public transit travel requires people to travel with strangers in a confined space, also known as a GM, cruise box, and a zooks, especially in large cities with very diverse populations. It's easy to feel intimidated by that experience. So mass transit's safer, it's cheaper, but god damn it, you know, I don't get to pump my own gas when I'm on the subway or on the bus. So it's not fun.
I mean, there's a lot, you know, I think most of us are aware that, you know, traveling by train or bus or by plane is safer than traveling in cars. And much safer, in fact. I think when the statistics mentioned in the article, I think we have it's about, what, 8 times more dangerous, 6 to 8 times more dangerous. My math is fuzzy. To travel in rural areas than it is to travel on bus, about 4 times more dangerous in urban areas. We've talked about this before, you know, that there are higher speeds in rural areas. Urban areas are typically more congested. You don't reach the higher speeds. And so you tend to have fewer fatalities. We've talked about small roads and road diets and how those contribute to that. Rail transit is, you know, about half as it's dangerous, I think. I mean, it actually... A lot of people it's kind of hard to visualize how these statistics are being presented, but it looks like, you know, clearly the automobile is the most dangerous mode of transport in the United States. And one thing that the article goes into detail on is to try to point out some of the bad way that public transit is associated with crime and other things. And they actually show that there's a long-term trend of crimes dropping fairly significantly on public transit. And even when you factor in the number of crimes on public transit into the experience versus the ones you experience in your car, there's really no comparison. I mean, public transit is absolutely going to be safer. I guess the problem is here, public transit is not available to a lot of us, particularly those of us who are in metro areas that don't have good public transit systems or who choose not to live in the city and really have no form of public transit at all, where we're ultimately forced to rely on vehicles in one shape or fashion.
Well, I look at it as most people in the United States live on the coasts, and both coasts, you know, have pretty good mass transit options. So I don't think there's any excuse. Sure, if you live out in the middle of the country, you might not have good transit. But I hate to bring it up. There's just not as many of you.
I mean, you live in the city with the best mass transit on earth, or at least in America, right? So
yes.
Other large cities on the East Coast do not have that great of a system, right? I don't think Atlanta or,
okay,
you know,
from
Miami.
From Boston to D.C.
Right.
From Boston to D.C.
Right. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Even, I mean, D.C., the metro is adequate, but I mean, it's not even close to as integrated into the city as I would say New York's is. I mean, there's still a lot of places out in the D.C. suburbs where you're driving, you know, 20 minutes to get to the train, and if you want to take it, and it's generally going to be a much faster commute if you drive into the city instead of taking the metro. And, you know, most people, you know, even me, when I look at my commute, and, you know, right now I am out about, you know, an hour and a half outside the city, and if I wanted to take the metro, I could drive around 40 minutes and then get on a metro and take a 75 minute ride into the city, which basically means my commute's 2 hours, or, you know, it's an hour and 20 minutes for me to drive directly. So, you know, a round trip, that's 40 minutes each way that I would save in a car. It gives me an hour and a half of my life back every day. That's it's hard to compete with those numbers when you're a public transit system and people value their time.
Right. But you can, you know, public transit, you can read a book, you can listen to an audio podcast, you can listen to this podcast, yeah. And then you can go, oh, while I'm waiting on the train, I can go to autosafety.org and click on that red donate button. And oh, I've done something better with my life, and I haven't covered the inside of my windshield with spittle, and no one's waving a gun at me. Because this Scientific American article, it's really good. It's even just worth just glancing at, because the thing that surprised me was on crime versus public transit versus on the road. And basically, motor vehicle theft is crazy. It's going up. And then they're talking about the number of road rage incidents involving guns. It's like, oh my God, like these things are off the scale compared to the crimes you
get. Well, without putting too fine a gloss on it, criminals tend to prefer to act in private. They don't really, if they plan things out, they don't really like to do it in public. You know, witnesses and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of inconvenient for the criminal enterprise, and except in the case of Donald Trump, but that is clearly a special case.
That's just the new America. My wife tells this story about how years ago she was on the subway, and it was outside crossing a bridge, crossing the East River, and these teenagers came on with guns and were robbing everybody, and these people on the subway wanted to pull the emergency stop. And she's like, no, don't do that, because then the train will stop on this bridge. No one can get to us. Like, what is wrong with you? So public transit's safe, but they got to remove that emergency stop thing because it's stupid. Anyway, no one disagrees because I'm right. Let's move on to the things that the DMV allows that it shouldn't allow. This is an article from Cal Matters titled, Seven Takeaways, How the DMV Allows Dangerous Drivers to Stay on the Road. And, oh my God, what a horrific article. I'm going to start. Irvin Wyatt's history behind the wheel spreads across two pages of a recent court filing. Fleeing police again, running a red light, causing a traffic collision, driving without a license four times, a dozen speeding tickets. Yet the California DMV issued him a license in 2019. Wyatt promptly got three more speeding tickets, court records show. Prosecutors said he was speeding again in 2023, when he lost control and crashed into oncoming traffic, killing three women. He now faces murder charges. This is another thing that we've discussed here is like, why? I mean, we talked about this with speeding last week. It was, why do people keep getting to drive their cars if they're doing so poorly? Like, you're not going to keep driving a train if you have an incident. You're not going to keep flying if you're like, I landed halfway on the wing. Like, no one's going to do this. But with cars, it's just like, just go right ahead. Keep going out there.
It did highlight one problem in this article, which is about intra-government communications. Apparently, not all the agencies are able to access all of the data that other agencies have, including those relevant to driving operations. So that was a problem, but yeah, clearly this is something that needs more attention. The whole idea that somebody who's a chronically bad driver is able to continue driving with a license that has not been even suspended or revoked.
This is a California-focused article. I mean, that's what Cal Matters writes about, but I would imagine that similar issues exist across almost every state. I mean, we've seen problems with getting speeders off the road in Washington, D.C. We've talked about it in a number of different states, and there just doesn't seem to be a really good mechanism that exists in these states for tracking bad drivers and getting them off the road. I mean, we have in this article, numerous examples of people who are injured or killed by reckless or speeding drivers, and those reckless or speeding drivers still have licenses and are still being issued licenses. So there could be a disconnect in the communications between law enforcement and the Department of Motor Vehicles. There could be a lot of reasons for this, but those reasons need to be looked at really closely across the United States so that we can hone in, because we know that the people who speed and are the most aggressive and who are the most intoxicated are the ones killing the most people on our roads. So you know, the smart thing to do here is to make sure that the systems that are tasked with keeping that behavior in check are working, and they don't appear to be.
How does that happen? Because, you know, you think if you get DUI, at least I think in New York, like they take your license away and you have to go for some period of time, or, you know, even minor traffic violations, they'll put points on your license. And if you collect a certain number of points, they'll yank your license. Is that just a more of a New York specific thing? No, because I remember living in D.C. D.C. had like zero tolerance. Like your blood alcohol level, if it was over 0.0, you were getting a ticket and a fine.
Yeah.
Which, great. But is this more of a California DMV thing, which we've discussed about the issues of California's DMV being inadequate? Or is there something being done to change this behavior? Because in California, if you get pulled over driving drunk, I imagine they'll yank your license.
Yeah, I got to think that they do as part of the DUI process. I mean, this looks like, you know, this looks like a lot of this might be people who are involved in a crash. Say you're in a rollover crash and you have a passenger in your car and that passenger dies and you were speeding, but for whatever reason, the police, you know, don't find you at fault, or maybe you're even prosecuted and you know, the case falls through, you're not guilty. Your license then wouldn't be suspended. Well, so it's, you know, there has to be some kind of finding by a court that you were at fault before you can have your license revoked. And so maybe a lot of these are people whose cases weren't prosecuted for whatever reason, or, you know, who hired a great lawyer to get them off, or whose daddy is the judge. You just really don't know. But it makes you think that maybe there should be a more direct connection between DMV and law enforcement, so that as soon as someone gets a reckless driving ticket or a DUI, you know, licenses should be being looked at that point based on, you know, a determination made by the DMV of whether you have the privilege to drive, and then your criminal charges should be considered separately.
I imagine, like, why couldn't it be like if you try to use your credit card and they're like, sir, your credit card's been declined. Can you try it again? Oh, it's still declined. They're asking me to cut it in half. Why can't the police do that with your driver's license? I'm sorry, it's been declined because you're drunk. And yes, you're driving a Ford SUV Explorer and it rolled over. We know it's going to roll over, but you should have known by now because you should have been supporting the Auto Center for Auto Safety.
Well, and ultimately, this comes back to something I think we talked about last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, was, you know, even if folk have their licenses suspended or don't even have a license at all, many of them are still going to choose to drive, and there's no way to stop that unless we implement Anthony's put your license in a slot in the car to turn the car on system.
I still like that one.
I don't like that one so much as I guess Trump wants to send them all to El Salvador. Maybe that'll work better. But, you know, there is another consideration, which Michael has talked about earlier or in earlier episodes. But rural people, they've got to get to the Piggly Wiggly to buy groceries, and they've got to be able to get somewhere to work. And in a country that has virtually no public transportation, particularly in rural areas, when you pull somebody's licenses, you're pulling the plug on all the resources they need to live. So I think judges tend to consider that very carefully in their assessment of whether or not to pull somebody's license. The conversation here seems to be moving in the direction of, you know, let's just hang them and figure out the consequences later. I don't know.
Yeah.
It is a complex problem in terms of
I'm being unreasonable.
People who have to live. People who have to live with the circumstances of their real life, and balancing that against the consequences of people who are lousy or dangerous drivers being allowed to continue to drive. And of course, as you just stated, the people who are prohibited from driving legally are not physically prohibited from driving. They will likely continue to drive illegally because they've got a job to support. They've got a family to support. So it's a complex situation. There's no simple answer to it, I don't think.
Robo-taxis.
Sure. That'll be great.
That will solve it all.
Yeah, when robo-taxis make it to rural America.
I'm still waiting up here in Beckett, Massachusetts.
Well, don't tell people where you are. Oh, you said Beckett. They'll never find you. With that, I'm going to enter my gaslight of the week.
It's a good plan. How's that sound? Good plan. Hit it.
I said robo-taxis. It is. Mine is a little company called Tesla. See, back in old 2016 when we were young, we were naive, we were bushy-tailed and whatnot. A little man from South Africa with a fake chin and hair plug said, "All the cars you buy from me today already have all the hardware you need to become fully autonomous." And people lined up and gave him wads of cash. And then he's like, "Nah, but I'll upgrade your computers and those systems for free. And that will work." And then it's like, "Oh, no." And so now if you're one of these people who fell for the scam, Tesla, you know, should be replacing your internal hardware, your computer system. And that would be, what, 4 million cars? More than 4 million cars?
Yeah.
And so if I go out and I buy something and it says, "This is going to work," and it turns out it's not, who's going to pay for it? Because Tesla's like, "Well, that's $4 million. Like, that's like $500 million. That's like what Elon spent on lunch." So that's,
yeah, I mean, they went from saying they were going to, they said they were going to upgrade everyone's system who actually bought self-driving, is now how they've classified. So the people who didn't subscribe to it, even when it was promised that your car has all the hardware for full self-driving, you know, 8 years ago, are out of luck because they didn't buy into the full self-driving at the time. I mean, at the time, I believe they were even saying that Teslas, you know, are the first car that's not going to depreciate. It's an appreciating asset because one day it's going to be fully self-driving. You're going to be able to send your Tesla out at night while you sleep to pick people up and make you some money. None of that happened, and none of it's going to happen because, you know, these cars they've got a lot more problems than just the computer before they get to full self-driving. But, you know, there is a very good argument here that a fraud was, you know, and there's a lot of fraud arguments around Tesla. This is one specific one, but that, you know, when you say these vehicles come with all the hardware necessary for full self-driving, and then a few years later, when you haven't delivered on that promise, you're not providing satisfaction to those people who have bought into that lie, there's a problem. And I'm sure there's a lawsuit ongoing around this. I didn't notice if that was mentioned in the article or not, but it's clearly false advertising. And not only that, but the retrofitting vehicles is an incredibly expensive process. I mean, here you're maybe popping a computer in and out. It isn't that difficult. The computer's going to cost money. The technician time's going to cost money. We see automakers fight tooth and nail to avoid recalls where, you know, the cost of the repair is going to be, you know, $500 or so or more, because when you multiply that times, you know, 4 million vehicles we're talking about here, that gets super expensive really fast and can turn into bankruptcy pretty quickly. So I expect Tesla is going to keep hedging its bets and trying to replace as few of these computers as possible, and, you know, continue along one of its many fraudulent paths that it started years ago.
Yeah, consumers, if you fell for this, and I'm not faulting you for falling for this back in 2016, but if someone says, "Hey, we have all the hardware work on a problem that we don't understand and we don't have a reliable solution for," it's not going to work.
I mean, yeah, we have all the hardware. We just don't know what software it's going to be running yet. Does that make any sense on any planet?
And we don't have any sort of basic heuristics of what the driving desk is really about, because it's a lot more complicated than you think. So for that, Tesla.
I'm going after Forbes
Magazine.
What
do you got?
Apparently Forbes Magazine is read by a lot of people. I'm not sure. I'm not a subscriber myself, but they've recently published an article called Gaydick which is the name of an autonomous driving company, GetIT notches key milestone in industry-first third-party safety audit. So it's very interesting because it's not the first, and yet it says it's the first. It's written by a guy named Richard Bishop, who happens to be an investor in Waymo, Aurora, and GetIT. So clearly something that's maybe questionable from a dispassionate viewpoint. Yeah. Let's see.
He's got the trifecta.
So he states GetIT is the dominant player in autonomous middle-mile logistics, which is interesting because there is no autonomous middle-mile logistics industry that exists. So being a dominant player in a non-existent industry, I guess you can be that if you want to be. They say a comprehensive safety assessment framework were independently validated by Tuve Sood. Anthony, you had some observations about that company in the past. For our listeners who have not participated in an audit, when an audit happens, you audit something relative to some specification, right? Like when you're audited by the IRS, you're audited relative to the federal tax code. If you're an industry being audited for, we'll say, manufacturing competence, you might be audited relative to a standard called ISO 9000. And you've probably seen the placards outside businesses, ISO 9000 or ISO 9001 compliant. The problem with the supposed audit, audit they have here is that there is no standard against which you can compare the AV's performance. He goes on to state, as part of the company's commitment to transparency and accountability across all aspects of this to safe testing and deployment, GetIT will soon be publicly sharing further information on progress made towards completion of the safety assessment framework prior to deployment. So what he's saying is they've been audited, but they still don't have the standards for which it's being audited. So the audit is a work in progress. So why would they then announce that it's been completed and everything's okie-dokie? Interesting. Mm-hmm. Could be. GetIT Safety Assessment Framework encompasses over 700 identified safety portfolios. What the hell? It's a bunch of word salad. Because in my experience, UL 4600 is a standard that has normative content. Now, normative content means that's something that you need to do. Like when you go to buy gasoline at the gasoline pump, right? It'll say 87 octane, for example, 90 octane, 95 octane. Okay, that octane rating is per a standard that was developed by, I think, the American Petroleum Institute. And you as a consumer don't need to worry about whether or not the 87 octane that Amoco is offering is different than the 87 octane that, we'll say, Sunoco is offering, because they're both audited to the same standard produced by a third party, which has normative consequences. People can take the standard, put it into a laboratory, and come up with a number. The fuel is 87 octane or it's not, right? So that's what a normative standard means. It means it has consequences. The automotive industry has been very careful and very active to make sure that all of the putative standards for autonomous vehicles actually are not standards. They're what they call best practices. They're not normative. They just have suggestions. Let me give you the fundamental one, which is the definition of safety that is universally adopted by the AV industry is that safety is the absence of unreasonable risk. Well, what's the problem with that? Every company is free to determine what is reasonable. So there's no universal standard as to what in fact is reasonable, and everybody's opinion is as good as everybody else's. The other part of that is that risk, remember they say unreasonable risk, has two parameters. One is the frequency of an occurrence. The second is the consequence of the occurrence. So let's consider a baby crossing, crawling across the street. Now, you as a human being would say, hell, I can't accept that. So you stop your car, you pick up the baby. This is real, by the way. This happens in carjackings where the carjacker will take the baby and just throw him out of the car, or take the car seat and put it by the side of the road. And Jeanette Fennell actually had this happen to her. So this is a real thing, even though it sounds hyperbolic. If you allow a consideration of risk to dominate your approach to that, you could say, well, it's very unlikely to occur. Hardly ever happens. So we're just going to say that's an unreasonable risk because it's so remote. We don't have to consider that. So when you look at the definition of safety as absence of unreasonable risk, you've got two weasel words in there that companies can hide behind. So there's no affirmative statement of what safety actually means within the industry. So when they talk about this standards being used to audit GADIC for safety, they're really talking about a bunch of best practices that have weasel words built in. So I'm running on here more than I really should. But proclaiming audit success as proof of safety, wow, based on vaporware and non-existent AV safety standard conformance, while also stating that the safety analysis is a work in progress, Forbes is this week's nominee for Gaslight of the Week.
Here, here, and they shouldn't allow babies to crawl across the street. Mr. Brooks, what do you got?
I think this is our first Gaslight that uses an anonymous source. Ooh. So I'm not sure who this gaslighter is, but this comes from, I believe it was a Financial Times article. We also have a link to it from Ars Technica. About Doge and their impact on NHTSA, which we've already discussed some of the staff losses at NHTSA. But one of the quotes talks about the reporting that NHTSA requires of semi-autonomous and autonomous vehicles, the Standing General Order, which we also talk about a good bit on this podcast. And one of the one person familiar, right? We know that Elon has never really liked the Standing General Order because Tesla is collecting a lot more data and better data than other companies. And so it reports a lot more crashes to the Standing General Order because it also has its entire fleet is enabled with technology that qualifies for the Standing General Order. Both autopilot and its full self-driving, whatever they call it now, full supervised self-driving, qualify for the Standing General Order anytime there's a crash in those vehicles. And so Tesla reports all those crashes to the government. And then when reporters do stories on it, sometimes the data is taken out of context because Tesla's reporting so many more crashes than everyone else. People assume that it's the Tesla systems that are always at fault in those crashes. It's not always the case, but I'll go into what this person said. They say, reporters see that we are reporting more incidents, many of which have nothing to do with autopilot and have told the wrong story about our safety record. There is a healthy amount of frustration about that dynamic. The idea our bar for safety is lower is just wrong. Well, it's not wrong. I mean, even if you take away all of those, reports about the magnitude of the numbers you're reporting to the government, you still have a significant chunk of the deaths and injuries that have been caused by level two technology. These are convenience systems. Autopilot and full self-driving have not been proven in any way to be safer than a decent human driver. And you're telling us that you shouldn't have to report these because the media is somehow misreporting things, rather than saying, none of these incidents are safety related, but a lot of them are. So the fact that you're claiming that the mass number of incidents that are reported is somehow a impediment to you being able to show the safety of your vehicles is incorrect. If you weren't selling these systems as more capable as they are. You weren't promising things, people things like full self-driving hardware in vehicles that doesn't exist. And then when these vehicles crash, you're now telling us that this shouldn't be reported to the public. Is the ultimate gaslight. You know, these are crashes that are happening on public roads, killing people and injuring people. And we deserve explanations for those things. And, you know, frankly, I do think Tesla's bar for safety is lower. I think that their company is built on a model that moves far too fast in areas that involve public safety. And you need your wings clipped a little. And having to report data on crashes is only the first step.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to say, Michael, you win this week's Gaslight. That was great. We have a few articles related to this. One from Scripps News, where I'm going to have a quote in here. Not me, but I'm going to read a quote. I was driving. I dropped my phone and looked down, and I ran a stop sign and hit the guy's car. That's a typical Tesla driver. They think, hey, the car's driving itself. I don't have to pay attention. And that's half user, half company PR marketing saying this stuff is safe. And that happens regularly. And a further article from this, one of the lawyers in this case says, these accidents happen over and over and over again. People aren't using this technology correctly. They're not trained and they don't understand it. I don't know why they don't understand it. Oh, that Elon
guy. You forgot to mention that a woman was killed in that particular incident.
We've had a lot of downbeat stuff on this. So if people want to read the whole thing, I'm trying to, you know, yes.
Well, I mean, the thing in that article that says it to me is talking about NHTSA's current investigations into Tesla. And, you know, they interviewed Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, and he was asked, you know, how independent are these investigations of Tesla going to be? And his response was 100%. Our investigations are not going to have any impact from any outside forces coming into play. Elon Musk is not the secretary. President Trump gave me the nomination. I'm running the department, which are encouraging words.
But I'm redoing my gaslight then. Sean Duffy, he wins.
But, you know, that's not the first time he has made that statement. He said in his nomination hearing that he was going to make decisions independent of Elon. And, it sounds like, you know, we don't know what's happening on the lower level. I mean, I think that the folks who remain in NHTSA's Office of Defects Investigation are doing their due diligence to the utmost extent that they can. I'm not sure how much they are going to be hindered by some of the political appointees that are coming into the Trump administration. I'm not sure, you know, the fact that the standing general order is still operating suggests that Elon doesn't have quite as much power within the Department of Transportation as he'd like to have, because I don't think there's any question that if he was given the choice today, that's crash reporting would be eliminated. So maybe there's something to this. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding. If, you know, Tesla vehicles continue operating, hitting emergency responders and motorcyclists and whatever else they can't see with their substandard camera autonomy, then, you know, maybe Musk does have some more influence than we think. We just really don't know what's going on behind the curtain over there at the political level enough to be able to say one way or another whether Duffy is playing straight with us here.
Well, I have a suggestion. He's not, but I just, you know, more cynicism than a suggestion. Let's keep going with Tesla, because here's an interesting one from thestreet.com. Tesla's been accused of basically breaking the odometers in their cars. Yeah. And this is fascinating. So there's a lawsuit that was filed on February 7th, quoting from the article, highlights that Tesla's warranties on vehicles are capped by mileage and are supposed to cover repairs and replacements necessary to correct defects in parts that it manufactures supplies. However, Tesla allegedly knowingly overstates the distance traveled in Tesla vehicles by manipulating odometers, allowing the company to dodge responsibilities tied to warranties. And so basically this guy bought a used Model Y, and then he's like, I got to take it to the repair shop all the time. And he's saying his routine for driving is 20 miles per day, but the vehicle saying it's 72.35 miles per day. And so what's going on there? I mean, are they, is it possible that Tesla's that insane that they're going to manipulate the odometer?
God, insane is the right word, because the federal odometer laws really don't play around. I mean, they were passed way back in 1972. And basically, they have both civil and criminal conditions. Then so you can be charged, criminally for altering odometers. And that's essentially what the allegation in this lawsuit is against Tesla, is that they are actively altering people's odometers. And even the word, I mean, something struck me as very odd in there. They said that, you know, they're using some type of predictive technology to determine how far your car drives. Like, you don't need it. You just need an odometer, right? Anytime. I mean, so the federal odometer law basically says, you know, you cannot advertise for sale, sell, use, install, or have installed a device that makes an odometer of a motor vehicle register mileage different from the mileage the vehicle was driven. It sounds like that's what Tesla's doing on a widespread basis to some extent. They're certainly violating any number of federal and state laws if, in fact, they are, you know, allowing the odometers in their vehicles to represent anything other than the base truth of how far that vehicle's traveled on the road. There's no such thing as a predictive odometer. An odometer is a measurement device, right? That's a really, really odd and really concerning report.
Yeah, it's interesting because this lawsuit comes after additional Tesla owners recently took to Reddit, so it must be true, to flag inaccurate readings on their odometers. So it seems, yeah, like someone said their 16-mile drive to work was clocked as 21 miles. Another one said they've owned their car for 5 months and it thinks it's already done 6,000 miles already. So you're saying this is federal and state? Because the feds might be like, yeah, let's not cover them.
I don't know if every single state has one. I know that they're very, a lot of states do, and there's a federal requirement as well. It's also super weird, and it seems really stupid for an auto company to do this, because, you know, some of the auto companies that have made the greatest name for quality and long-term reliability are folks like Toyota and Honda. And why on earth would you want to inflate the number of miles why would you buy a car where a manufacturer is inflating the number of miles on the vehicle? Because it's only going to drive down the resale price of those vehicles and make people less likely to buy your car. You know what I mean? It just doesn't make a lot of sense from my perspective. I mean, apparently Tesla's using it as a way to avoid having to pay out on warranties, right? So if you've got a 5-year, I don't know what Tesla's warranties are, but say it's a 5-year, 50,000 mile warranty or whatever, they're apparently trying to add, the allegation is they're trying to add miles to the vehicle so that they no longer qualify for the free repairs under warranty. But ultimately, I mean, that would simply drive down the price of vehicles that are then sold on to a second owner and, you know, in a way, drive down the perception of your brand in the public. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. Of course, it's Tesla, so God only knows what
they're thinking.
Michael,
I'm going to change my gaslight again. It's going to be you. You're the gaslight of the week because, as we've learned, Teslas are an appreciating asset. and with that, go about doing the Tao of Fred. I assume good.
You've now entered the Tao of Fred.
Oh, Fred
I'm
is
not
muted.
Muted.
Himself.
That's an awful thing to say about me.
I don't know how.
So we had interest in optics from Michael concerning the legend that's on the right-hand mirror in your car that says objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. So there's a convex mirror on the right-hand side of the car. Michael, is convex mirror required, or is that merely a manufacturer's option?
I don't even know the answer
what?
To that.
How is there an auto safety question you don't know the answer to? No.
Oh, no. Well, anyway,
Michael
we'll,
just left
while Michael
the,
rejoins,
the podcast.
We'll just go ahead and
How
talk
did
about
that
it.
Happen?
So a convex mirror is one that has a bulge in it. Concave mirror is the one that you might use on your in your bathroom for getting a closer look at the zits on your nose or something. So it in that case, it converges the light rays that are coming into it and focuses them. The convex mirror has a bulge in it, so it does the opposite. It spreads out the light rays coming into them so that it has a wider field of view than a flat piece of glass. And that's the objective of the design, to make sure that you have a good breadth of coverage in the right-hand mirror so you can see people, you know, near your car, and you can see people far away from your car, and you can also see people on the sidewalk. So it, I think it's probably apparent to people who have used them that, yes, it does, objects are closer than they appear, but that's the design objective because they want to give you a wide range of view while still having an acceptable resolution of the objects so that when you're making turns, for example, you've got as good as possible awareness of objects that might be around you or things that might be encroaching on your blind side as you make a turn. Is that?
I never thought of it. It's just it's because it's convex, huh? I just
yeah. A lot of cars now are having a
who knew
convex mirror also embedded in the left hand side mirror. So you not only get the accurate view from the flat part, but you get a wider view to give you better situational awareness. More objects in the field of view so that you can just have a better appreciation for what's around you as you turn left or as you turn right with your convex right-hand mirror. Michael, we lost you. Did you have something you wanted to add here?
Okay.
Yeah, I had, you know, it's one of the new, one of the problems with using new podcast software is that when you click over to take a quick look at Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard 111 and you do it inside of the browser window where the podcast is being recorded, it makes you leave the room. Mm. So there is a federal standard that addresses convex mirrors. They're not allowed on the driver's side. They are allowed on the passenger side. But there are certain requirements that are around that, but they're not mandated by any means.
All right, well, that's good to know.
That's Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard 111 for all the nerds out there who want to dig deep on that one.
All right, and well, nerd stuff, and let's do some
strap in.
Time
was that. Oh, no.
First one we're going to start with this week. That's the recall roundup intro. See, listeners, this is a little too much the sausage is made. Normally, all this stuff is added in post-production, and I assume these guys
listen to the show. Was that a cat being strangled, or is that a bagpipe?
So anyway. Look, this is, I don't need your critics. Anyway, Volkswagen, first one, 44,387 vehicles. The Audi A6, the Audi SQ8, the Audi, a bunch of other dumb names. This is the 2021 cars. The Audi, we're too lazy to come up with great names for cars. And it's just pages and pages of S's and R's and whatnot, but it's all the same year, 2021. And the vehicle's virtual cockpit instrument cluster may shut down because of detection of an internal fault. Uh-oh. When this occurs, the engine speed, vehicle gear, and mode indicators will not be displayed. Uh-oh. In addition to this, other information such as time, date, and mileage are also not displayed. That's horrible. And that happened to an F1 driver this past weekend in the Grand Prix. They got him on the radio and said, George, you may lose all display on your steering wheel. And he's like, okay, what do I do? Like, because that controls everything on those cars that are moving 200 miles per hour. Michael, what's going on here?
It looks like there's some type of, you know, age-related damage that involves one of the cables. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly. There's so many new names for things these days. I'm not sure what a virtual cockpit instrument cluster is. Shouldn't it be an actual cockpit instrument cluster? I want mine to be actual and I'm relying on it to drive safely. But anyway, this is a damaged cable essentially that causes the software to glitch. And it looks like the only fix here is not a new cable. You know, they're not, are they replacing the cable? Doesn't look like it. They're putting new software into your car. It looks like owners aren't going to be hearing about this till May 30th. So it's going to be another month and a half before you're able to look for a repair.
All right. Next, Porsche. Isn't Porsche also owned by Volkswagen?
Yeah, there's a lot of Volkswagen. Oh. Porsche, Audi. Yeah.
Let's not get ahead.
Porsche,
okay.
Audi, Volkswagen.
The 2024 to 2025 Porsche Macan Electric. Blurry or missing camera images. Due to a software issue that has since been corrected, the rearview image may not display when the reverse gear R is engaged. This is more rear camera nonsense. Come on, people with your rear cameras. So you put your car in reverse and it's like, dah, you can't see anything. And apparently if you own a Porsche, you lack the strength to turn your head and look behind you. No? Anybody?
There's just a lot of problems with this one. You know, there's bad bonding on the camera housing, moisture intrusion. They're having to give you new software to resolve the wake up and system communication issues. And they're replacing your reverse cameras and inspecting them. Well, they're inspecting them and replacing them as necessary to clear up any deficiencies there. So this just looks like a complete failure on Porsche's part to install working rear view cameras as required by Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards.
Which number? I knew it because we just did 111 for the convex mirrors. I'm on board. All right, next, Porsche. Porsche twice in 1 week. Oh my God. 9,735 vehicles. The 2022 to 2023 Porsche Taycan, which Fred drives, the airbag activation deactivation in the front passenger seat can trigger a fail-safe mode due to a manufacturing error, which deactivates the airbag in the front passenger seat. This is handy if you're driving with somebody you don't like.
And, you know, this is further evidence of the Porsche-Audi-Volkswagen connection because the next recall, which is an Audi recall, is the exact same thing.
No, it's
thing,
Volkswagen.
Right?
It's Audi. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a crimp issue, and basically that triggers a fail-safe mode that turns off your passenger seat airbag, and you simply don't have an airbag if you get into a crash if this is occurring. So there should be a warning lamp come on before this. If you see that, you know that you probably shouldn't be carrying passengers until you get this fixed. And it doesn't look like owners are going to be hearing about this one until June, so you know, almost 2 months from now. It looks like they've got repair parts ready to go, though, so you shouldn't have to wait too much longer past June to get this
fixed.
But
thanks to tariffs, this will cost you $9,000.
Hey, recalls are still free. We don't care what tariffs do.
I just want to get back into these for a second. Because last one is Michael. What a crimp failure means is that when the cable is put together, there's a metal end on it, which holds the plug, if you will, that goes into the connector. And when they crimp it, it just means they squeeze the metal so that it can hold on to the cable and become a structural unit. So when they say they have crimp issues, basically they squeezed it too much probably and caused the insulation inside the connector to degrade in some way or break. The other item was the virtual cockpit instrument cluster. And basically, all that means is that you've got a video screen in front of you, and they project certain instruments onto it, like, you know, a tachometer or a speedometer or what have you. So they're just talking about the way that the basic operational information for your car is projected onto the video screen that sits in front of the steering wheel. So that's all that's about. But the first one is particularly interesting because it illustrates one of the problems with AVs, which is that it's uniquely associated with the manufacturing process for the electronics. And if an AV has a similar problem, it will cease to operate. And so this is one of the many safety issues associated with AVs that don't really affect a conventional car because a conventional car has an actual live human being who can compensate for this kind of failure. Timing failures are one of the issues that affect all computers, and this ultimately is a timing failure associated with bad manufacturing. So I just wanted to cycle that back into our concerns about the unique safety issues of AVs, and the analysis for AV safety has got to go deeper than just saying, well, you know, it looks a lot like a human car except better.
And Michael, you had a crimp issue back in the early 90s when you had a perm, right?
Yeah, and I had to get that straightened. It just didn't work out.
All right, so the last recall again is Volkswagen 2022-2023 Audis e-trons. It's the same crimp issue, 3,730. Hear about that in June. And until then...
Bye, everybody.
Yeah, this is that part of the show. You guys can actually hear the outro music. Yeah, if you'd like to, and then you should go to autosafety.org, click on donate. You should click subscribe, give 5 stars, tell your friends, families, neighbors, people you don't even like, people you really like.
Electronic issues persist, don't they? They're wonderful. What could possibly go wrong?
Autosafety.org.
Bye. Okay. Hopefully this recorded.
Yeah, I hope so, because I've got a lot to do before 3 o'clock.